This program was brought to you by the Academy Opus Caseus, whose training programs bring cheese professionals to the next level.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today I am so pleased to welcome Nina Teicholz, author of The Big Fat Surprise. Welcome, Nina.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Oh, I'm so delighted. Anyway, first I want to tell the listeners the whole title of your book, because that's a tip-off as to what it's about. It's called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. And I don't think I have read a more shocking or more political book during my two-year tenure as book reviewer on Cutting the Curd. My eyes kept popping out of my head.
I think I'm glad to hear that.
Definitely. First, let's summarize. I feel since this isn't a cheese book per se, this is a book that not many of my listeners are familiar with. So I would like you, Nina, first, how would you explain the major findings in this massive healthy diet research review in a sentence or two? What do you say when asked at a party, what's your book about?
My book is the first attempt to really put together the history, the politics, and the arguments to explain why saturated fats are not bad for health. Those are the fats in butter, meat, cheese, dairy, eggs, and they have for 50 years been the number one culprit that we've been told not to eat. But it turns out that was always based on soft science and really is not true.
Okay. This is, just to say it again in a different way, this was my try at describing what the book is about. A very in-depth science research-oriented history of how the heart-healthy diet research world got hijacked, sort of, into the wrong low-fat direction years ago, and how through a combination of egos, perhaps act of conspiracy, big food money, just kept going, immune to more thorough analysis of scientific findings. And all the while, our country's health has plummeted.
That's a very good description, and you're absolutely right. I mean, the book's been called a nutrition thriller. It really attempts to tell this question that is at the center, must be at the center of everyone's mind, which is, why are we as a nation getting so fat and sick?
Right.
And we have, in fact, been following the official advice over the past 30 years. Red meat is down by 17%. Eggs are down by nearly 20%. Mm-hmm. You know, we've increased whole grains by 40%.
Mm-hmm.
We've cut fat, increased, you know, we've done pretty much everything that we've been told to do, and
right,
our health looks worse for it.
Right.
So, the truth is we really just got the basic low-fat advice wrong. That has not been good advice from the start, and a tremendous amount of science really exists now to show that diet, the diet restricted in fat and saturated fat, leads to poor health.
Mm-hmm. But we're not really waking up. It doesn't seem like we're waking up very quickly.
You know, the answer to that is that some people are, but our experts are not.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
there is a groundswell of interest in traditional diets that go back to, you know, natural foods that people used to eat, butter and cheese and meat.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the foods that
mm-hmm.
people used to eat. They didn't used to pour vegetable oils invented in 1940
right.
over their foods.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a groundswell of interest. There's a lot of interest in the diabetic community because it turns out that having a higher fat diet helps people get off their diabetes medication. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of interest. But at the expert level, there's a kind of entrenchment, digging in of the heels, and even a kind of doubling down on existing advice. So the expert community is driving ever more towards a plant-based diet.
Yeah, crazy.
More and more plants, you know, I mean, one of the really amazing findings is that, you know, that diet really has no evidence to show that it's healthy or nutritionally sufficient, which is even worse news.
Right, right. I want to talk about how you got to this topic historically, because I know you've been working on the book for years and years. What brought you to this topic at first?
First, it was an article that was assigned to me by Gourmet on trans fats that really kind of, it was a groundbreaking article and led to a book contract. And once I started to research dietary fat, which is, you know, the subject that nutrition science has obsessed about most, good fat, bad fat, how much fat do we eat? I mean, we've been obsessing about it for generations.
Right.
I realized there was a much bigger story about all fats here. And one of the things that tipped me off was just finding this community of scientists who were terrified to talk about the science. It was like interviewing the mob. I would get off the phone shaking, and I realized, you know, why were people so afraid to talk?
Now, do you mean
transparent field?
Do you mean the small group of people who were going against the main research findings?
Yes, because the obvious question is how is a bad hypothesis about what makes people healthy been able to survive for so long?
Right.
And one of the answers is that the critics were silenced. They were marginalized. They are not allowed to. They weren't given research grants, or their grants were taken away. They couldn't get their findings published in research papers. Mm-hmm. And those critics and people, basically scientists in the opposition, became there's a fear that that suffused through that community and over the field of nutrition science generally, where people are truly afraid to speak their minds.
Now, weren't you progressively shocked by what you were finding?
Yes. I mean, you know, I started out as a vegetarian a near vegetarian. I had a little bit of chicken and fish, but I really was not open to these ideas at all. And it took me a long time to really unfold them all and understand the corporate forces that are involved, you know, the vegetable oil companies and how deeply they've been involved in influencing nutrition science. And, you know, it's just so often true in the course of this research, you simply cannot believe what you find. You know, I had to, I cannot tell you how many times I would look at something that I had written and think, I need to talk to 10 more people to be sure this is true, because I can't believe it's true.
Right.
Which is why the book took so long to write.
Yes. I was going to ask, how long did the research take, first of all?
You know, the whole book took about 9 years to do. And I'm not saying they were all fruitful years. There were years spent just cultivating sources in the vegetable oil industry. But it did take a really long time. There are thousands of studies in the field of nutrition science. And I really wanted to not rely on review papers, but go back to all the original data sources and read them all myself and really dig down to understand who funded them, what were their attitudes, you know, what was the methodologies. That took a very long time.
Right, I can imagine. Now, what was your previous background in? Do you have a research degree, or were you learning as you were doing the research?
I studied biology and was pre-med at Stanford when I was there, and I had 1 year at Yale. But
I don't have
a degree in science, and it was learning. I had a tutor in other science journalists who taught me about the field of nutrition. I have to say that in this field of challenging the existing ideology or dogma or prevailing hypothesis on nutrition, all of this has come from outsiders. I feel like if I had come up in the world of nutrition science, I would not have been able to write this book because you know, you're taught a certain way of thinking, and it's the outsiders are the ones who have brought a fresh view to the science. So I just say that as part of the way of my defense. I mean, it should not be a journalist writing this book. I mean, this should be scientists. But
right.
You know, nobody would dare to put their name to something like this, I think, is part of the reason.
What was your schedule like during these years? Is this the only thing? Were you primarily working on the book? And was it an all-day job? And
it was. I'm also a mom. I have two boys. And so, but I was home, and I would say, yes, I just worked absolutely relentlessly on this. I mean, really, from morning till night.
And you can see the depth and the quality of your reach is impressive. I mean,
Thank you
clearly are turning over every stone, and the number of articles you reference is incredible.
You know, it's a very contentious field, and as everybody knows, you can go out and find nutrition studies on every side of an issue. You can find articles to prove any which way. And so for there to be some kind of definitive account, you have to leave no stone unturned and really understand this is the entire universe of studies on something. So I can say this conclusively.
Right.
Because otherwise you're just whipsawed by the winds of every recent study back and forth. And that's not helpful for people.
And it sounds like there were, you know, way more studies supporting the status quo than the studies that weren't.
That's a complex issue. There are many review papers that that selectively interpret the data.
Yes.
But you know, take on an issue like saturated fats. There are the only reason that we think that saturated fats are bad for us is basically ignoring the vast majority of data on that subject. So, and that is really. And you know, so for instance, our government report saying that saturated fats are bad for us, that formal review, they based their conclusion on studies that involve only 85 people over in studies that last 20 to 35 days. And what isn't in that reviewed in that are all the government funded studies on nearly 15,500 people in studies for 1 to 12 years. That's the evidence that is excluded.
So what proved their point was 85 people for a month, and what didn't prove their point was 15,000 for years, and so they rely on the weaker data.
Yeah, that sliver of data.
Right.
That's why you aren't eating butter, meat, cheese, dairy,
exactly.
eggs. You think they are giving you heart disease.
And that's why my eyes were popping out of my head, because I just was shaking my head saying, you know, I have a degree in psychology, so I had to study research, and I know about, you know, control groups and a lot of what you're talking about. And it just was, how did these people get away with proving things with such limited numbers and studies and ignoring the holes in them?
You know, there are a number of answers to that. I think the strongest one is that this hypothesis that fat and saturated fat cause heart disease got adopted early on by the American Heart Association in 1961, by the entire federal government in 1980, and then it was institutionalized.
Right.
Institutions cannot back out on their advice. They're the opposite. They do the opposite of good science. They have to be steady, not self-questioning, not flip-flopping on their publics, whereas science needs to be self-doubting and nimble and responsive to new observations.
Right.
So it's impossible, I think, for these large institutions to be the stewards of good science. There was also, of course, the influence of industry behind this. I mean, as I said, the vegetable oil industry has been deeply involved. And, of course, when you get rid of saturated fats, what was the alternative that was recommended? Unsaturated fats, which are vegetable oils. So they successfully manipulated that.
But it seemed like in your history that first the errors were made and it was scientists that were backing them. And then it gained, you know, business, food, big food money to go along with it. Is that, was that just my reading of the chapters, or
you know,
was that...
I think the answer to that is truly unknown, but I who knows when the industry started to get involved and really fund companies. It goes way back to, mm-hmm. you know, I dug up evidence back in the 1940s of how Procter & Gamble, the maker of Crisco oil, launched the American Heart Association as a national organization. Mm. But that said, I do think that the ultimate gatekeepers of our nutrition recommendations, our policy, are scientists. Scientists are the ones who look at those studies, evaluate them, and should say, you know, no, this doesn't add up. Mm-hmm. They are the gatekeepers of our new recommendations, and they're ultimately to blame.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there anyone who encouraged you in the heart health diet world?
What do you mean, encouraged me?
Like encouraged your investigation and were, you know, kind of cheering you on and saying, yes, 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 this has been wrong for years, and please write an expose.
Yes. In fact, there have been people who, and I write about one of them in my book, Ron Krause, who mm-hmm. is one of what I call the nutrition aristocrats, the top mm-hmm. tier of scientists who really are in control of nutrition policy. He was twice chair of the American Heart Association Nutrition Committee, which is mm-hmm. considered a plum job. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he was a major source for my book, and I think that he was happy to hear this story told, but as were other people. But, you know, I have to say the dominant feeling out there in the community is one of fear still.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Did you get any official flack from the status quo?
I have had the American Heart Association on the day my book came out. They published a statement saying, we stand by our recommendations on saturated fat and pay no attention to that book, didn't want to name.
Okay.
And I have had some blowback from people who are, you know, the defenders of the government diet. There's a group in Washington named Center for Science in the Public Industry that's very involved in defending those recommendations. They have mm-hmm. attacked me. I mean, it's predictable. I expected it mm-hmm. to be attacked. And so... You know, but I think that strategy that has worked for the nutrition aristocrats for so many decades is one they also employ towards me, which is silence. Let's pretend she doesn't exist or mm-hmm. just tell mm-hmm. her, say, you know, our response is she's just out to sell books or...
Uh-huh.
So there has not been, I would say what is most disappointing is there has not been to date any meaningful engagement with my arguments.
Okay.
I mean, just putting me aside.
Right.
And I wish that that would happen. But that also tells me that maybe there really is no response to, you know, maybe there is no really good defense.
Right. You've been too thorough and too convincing.
I would like to think so.
Now, as a cheese lover and eater, of course, I'm delighted to think eating cheese has been redeemed. But it's hard to fathom that so much of what you think could be wrong.
It is hard to change our fundamental ideas that we've grown up with for so long. And, you know, I sympathize deeply with that. I mean, that idea that fat makes you fat, the fat in cheese is going to become the fat on your body, is so deeply ingrained, especially, you know, for all of us.
Right.
But it really turns out that a higher fat diet, including saturated fat, mm-hmm. is far healthier. Mm-hmm. It leads to better outcomes for losing weight, for diabetes, for, you know, a good number of your cardiovascular risk factors, which turn out to be the more significant risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, restricting carbohydrate, you know, right now we're told to eat basically a high carbohydrate diet. Between 50 and 60% of our calories is carbohydrates. That's mm-hmm. bread, pasta, cereal, grains. Those are fine for healthy people in moderation, but we've increased carbohydrates by 25% over the last 30 years, and mm-hmm. that seems to have tipped Americans into a series of metabolic diseases, mm-hmm. which are obesity, diabetes, heart disease.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back to discuss more specifics with Nina Teicholz, author of The Big Fat Surprise. Be back soon.
The Academy Opus Caseus is the cheese industry's unique center for professional development, offering training for cheese professionals ready to move their careers to the next level. The Academy is the only professional cheese school integrating hands-on practice, formal instruction, and curriculum-related visits in every course. The Academy's core courses for mongers and affineurs are offered at the Mons facilities in France, and abridged courses are offered in Vermont, California, and London. A structured discipline of sensory analysis is practiced daily. The Academy has been recognized by the American Cheese Society as an approved education center for those preparing for the Certified Cheese Professional Exam. Here's a reading of a quote from Kevin Palmaccio, a graduate of the program.
The balance of time is what sets essential foundations apart from other educational opportunities. While the classroom is important, spending time at the goat farm and working alongside the Mons staff immersed us in real work and taught me real skills I've already applied in my career. As a relative newcomer to the cheese business, daily concentration on sensory analysis was paramount. As a cheesemonger, I'm now in a better position to familiarize myself with a wide range of products and sell with more confidence.
For more information and to apply for courses, visit their website at academy-mons.com. That's academie-mons.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, it's Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd, talking to Nina Teicholz, who wrote The Big Fat Surprise. Nina, we're back. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
So, one thing I thought maybe we could explain to the audience was the causality versus association quandary, and do you think that was the beginning of the first errors?
Good question. So there are basically two types of scientific studies. There's a kind called epidemiological or observational studies. That's one kind, and they can show associations, but they cannot prove causation. So they can show, say, red meat eating seems to be associated with higher rates of heart disease, but they can't show that red meat causes heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other kinds of studies called clinical trials, where you actually take a group of people and you feed them, and
mm-hmm.
you have a control group, and then you can control their diet enough so you know exactly what causes what. They can show causation. So you
right.
can feed one group a lot of meat, one group a little meat, and show,
see
oh,
how
it's
they
the
do.
Meat eating that's causing heart
mm-hmm.
disease. There
mm-hmm.
are difficulties with both of those kinds of studies, but clinical trials are generally considered far more rigorous.
Right.
The problem in nutrition science is that it has been driven by this weaker kind of science that can
mm-hmm.
only show association, and it is true that that's how it all started. In the 1950s, there was a huge epidemiological study called the Seven Country Study that seemed to show a correlation, but not causation, between low amounts of meat or saturated fats in a diet and low rates of heart disease. And it was on the basis of that, really, that study alone, that the American Heart Association decided to issue recommendations to all of them to, at that point it was just men, middle-aged men, not
mm-hmm.
to eat saturated fats to prevent
mm-hmm.
heart disease. And that was like the little acorn that grew into the giant oak tree of advice we have today. But it was always based on just that weak
mm-hmm.
kind of evidence. That
now,
remains a huge problem
mm-hmm,
today.
Mm-hmm. Now, diet research is hard to conduct because controlling people what they eat or giving them food to eat and doing it over a long period of time is very tough.
Right. So
so that's why I think the association research is popular.
That's why it's done. It's easier to give somebody a survey and say, hey, what did you eat yesterday? And
mm-hmm.
then check back in 20 years and then find out who's died and who hasn't died and who died of
right.
heart disease. And,
right.
But there's so many problems with that research. I mean,
mm-hmm.
turns out people don't remember very well what
right.
they ate yesterday.
Right.
And
or they lie.
They try to confirm it, but it's very difficult, and most of our recommendations are based on this kind of weak research, and when they've actually gone and tried to test whether or not the findings from those observational trials are true, in other words, can they be confirmed in clinical trials, it turns out that they fail 80 to 100% of the time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So they're just completely unreliable.
Right.
And what
your book does that I thought was particularly interesting is you go back over all these studies and you see the little things they forgot to mention that they left out. Like one of them is they showed that some people were healthier, but then it turned out it was Lent. So they were eating less meat anyway?
Yeah.
And
that original seven country study that was so important in formulating the American Heart Association recommendation. So their star subjects were on the island of Crete, these peasants who seemed to live forever and tilled the soil and didn't seem to eat much meat. But that's because one of the study periods when they went to look at them, it was during Lent.
Right.
So they were avoiding meat.
Right. So, which was wild that, you know, it was buried, you found it in the study, but it wasn't mentioned as a possible conflicting situation.
You know, one of the general truths about these studies that, as I look through them, is that scientists do not want to, they don't want to highlight the flaws of their studies.
Right.
You know, it doesn't get you a headline, or you can't get your paper studied if you say, oh, you know, we messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And we went during Lent.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that turns, you know, that, it was like being a detective to go through these studies to find mm-hmm. those little details.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, we forgot to control for smoking. You know? Well, that's a huge flaw. That's a flaw
right.
so big that your study should not be published. And
right.
the scientists writing up that study knew it, so
right.
they don't mention it.
Right. Were the first scientists just egotistical?
There's definitely an aspect of sort of the great man theory driving nutrition science history, which is that the early scientists, there's really one of the most famous is Ansel Keys, who's really the most important nutrition scientist and the most influential of the
mm-hmm.
20th century. He was a pathologist at the University of Minnesota, and he was really an aggressive, outsized personality who had an unshakable belief in his own ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And he was described to me by his colleagues as, you know, you would talk to Ansel Keys, you would argue with him for an hour, he could convince anybody of anything.
Uh-huh.
And he used a lot of really bamboozling tactics. He criticized people. He was relentless in his opposition to arguments that didn't agree with him.
So he was a bully.
He was really a bully.
Uh-huh.
And he was very successful.
Yeah. And he figures throughout the story. I mean, he seems to be one of the most steadfast supporters of low fat and caused the most trouble in getting it established.
He was the leader of that study, the seven country study,
mm-hmm.
and he was absolutely instrumental in then getting the American Heart Association to
mm-hmm.
Adopt the idea that saturated fats are bad for health.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was involved heavily throughout the 50s and the 60s and
mm-hmm.
the 70s, and he and his colleagues used to really relish the fight against their opponents.
Uh-huh.
They were really out to conquer.
Mm-hmm. And he lived to be 100 years old, died in 2004, I believe, and you are mentioned in his Wikipedia profile.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, see, you're famous.
I can't imagine that's a favorable mention.
It might not be. No, but I think it's said that, you know, you've challenged some of his beliefs.
Well, I'm not the first person.
Right.
There have been many journalists. I should mention that Gary Taubes was really the first, the pioneering journalist to in this field. And
he wrote a cover article in the New York Times Magazine, I believe?
He did. In 1999, I think it was, he had an article in Science Magazine that first really documented how the soft science, I think it was called The Soft Science Behind Dietary Fat. And
uh-huh.
then he followed up with a cover story in the New York Times Magazine, 2001. And that opens with the scene of people imagining, the top nutrition experts imagining, what if they had all been horribly wrong? And he's really the, you know, what I think of as the godfather of this whole field, because it was those articles triggered scientists read them, even though nobody
mm-hmm.
would talk about them.
Uh-huh.
I had a number of conversations where that
mm-hmm.
opened with, if you're going to take the Gary Taubes line, I will not even talk to you.
Uh-huh.
But scientists read them, his ideas percolated out through the research community, and that is why we now have a body of evidence on carbohydrate restriction. His, you know, the idea that Gary had was that it was carbohydrates, not fat, that
right.
drove metabolic diseases.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk briefly about the whole trans fat thing, because that, I feel like, could be a book in and of itself.
Well, that's how my book started out.
Okay.
And the trans fat story is complicated. You know, the
we invented them. We invented trans fats, right?
Trans fats entered the food supply in 1911 with Crisco shortening.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, trans fats occur when you take a vegetable oil and you harden it.
Right.
It's a process called hydrogenation.
And you need the hardened fat for baking. Is that true?
For all food manufacturers,
okay.
you need a hard fat.
Okay.
You know, what used to be used was almost exclusively butter and lard.
Mm-hmm.
And then vegetable oils were invented in the early 1900s. But you can't use them as oils. They're greasy. They don't.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make a cake with vegetable oils. It doesn't have the same texture. So you need a hard fat for baking, cooking, all manufacturing.
Okay.
And hardening fats through hardening oils through hydrogenation achieved that. It
right.
was an incredible advance
mm-hmm.
in the history of food processing, but a byproduct of that hardening was trans fats.
Right.
Trans
Which
fats,
are in all of them.
Well, it depends on how hard your oil becomes.
Okay.
So, you know, there are many more in, say, a hard chocolate coating than there are in just regular vegetable oils, which are just called, it's called touch hydrogenation, just produces a little amount of trans
okay.
fat.
Okay.
And there were indications that trans fats might be bad for health going back to the 1950s.
Uh-huh.
But there was basically a pretty extensive effort to cover up any negative health effects
okay.
By the vegetable oil industry until the early 90s,
mm-hmm.
and then, or even into the late 90s, and then they gave up because the trans fats were out of the bag. They're clearly not good for health.
Now, why do you think trans fats got uncovered and then, gotten rid of pretty much so easily almost compared with the whole low-fat thing?
The reason that trans fats could become a sort of boogeyman is
mm-hmm.
that going after them does not,
mm-hmm.
it points the finger to the food industry for obesity and diabetes, right? It's better to point that at to somebody else rather than to point it, nutrition experts pointing at themselves to say,
okay.
oh, we've gotten it wrong.
Okay.
So that's why you'll see, any effort to try to point the finger at big food rather than say, oh, our fundamental advice to you is wrong, is inaccurate.
Okay.
We made a terrible mistake.
Okay.
Trans fats really serve that purpose. I'm not saying trans fats are good for health, but I certainly do not think that they cause obesity or diabetes and none of that has, or heart disease, really. All of that evidence is quite weak.
Okay.
However, it's better not to use them. And the question I raise in my book is just that, okay, when you get rid of hardened vegetable oils, what replaces them? We can't go back to butter, lard, and tallow, which we used to use. You know, McDonald's used to fry their French fries in tallow. We
mm-hmm.
can't go back to them because they have saturated fats in them, and there's still a taboo about using saturated fats to the point where literally you can't put the word healthy on your food product if you have saturated fats in it, more than a gram per serving.
Right.
So what are food companies to do now? They're really in a bind, and what they're turning to are a bunch of novel, untested specialty oils with, you know, probably another trans fat in
right, right.
20 years. There's something called interesterified oil. You know, you don't even want to know what
that
is.
Oh, that sounds scary.
But it's a scary, novel thing that came out of a chemistry lab.
Mm-hmm.
And when the FDA decided to get rid of these hardened vegetable oils, they really didn't ask what would replace them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some scary consequences to that.
Yeah.
And what we should do is just to go back to natural fats. That's, you know, why you saw Mark Bittman write a column in the New York Times saying, oh, we should have maybe a little butter and lard, because he realizes that.
Mm-hmm. But he's also saying be vegan till dinner.
Well, he is trying to say a lot of different things. I mean, it's difficult for the people who are defenders of the plant-based diet, because if you agree a higher fat diet is healthier, which is sort of undeniable now, where are you going to get those fats?
Right.
Fats come most naturally in animal foods. You've got the head of Tufts Nutrition School literally saying, well, you should just pour soybean oil all over your vegetables.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that sounds terrible, mm-hmm. and is not historically how humans have eaten.
Right. Where is there new research happening on the diet front?
Well, it's very hard to get funding for real research on this issue because the government directs its research dollars to irrelevant questions like where do people snack? Do they snack? What location? Or, it's purposely mm-hmm. driven away from the central topics, which are, is our diet actually providing good health? But there is some good research that's happening. Ohio State is doing, there's interesting research. Gary Taubes actually became a founder of a center called NUSI, which is actually funding clinical trials to do some original research.
Mm-hmm.
It remains hard to get good, mm-hmm. to get money to do this kind of research.
Now, what's your feeling about gluten-free?
I haven't reviewed the science on that, so I'm reluctant to say anything on it. But I do know that, in general, when people reduce carbohydrates, they feel healthier in many mm-hmm. different ways. Gluten, mm-hmm. I think, in some ways is a marker for carbohydrate intake. When people reduce the foods with gluten, it may be the carbohydrate reduction that is improving health. I don't know that.
Right.
I believe people who question whether there is actually so much gluten intolerance in America.
Right. I mean, I was thinking just in terms of your book and your findings that maybe gluten-free was sort of starting as something popular to get people to think they shouldn't be eating all the bread that they were told to eat by the heart diet people.
Right, but it turns out that the gluten-free movement has been taken, nutrition science is full of unintended consequences. So now there's all these high-carb, gluten-free products.
Oh, okay.
You can eat a whole diet of gluten-free, muffins, cookies, cakes, and healthier diet for most people.
Now, what do you think about vegan and the sort of opposite paleo?
So vegan and the vegetarian diet, the vegan diet is, it's impossible for that diet to be nutritionally sufficient.
Uh-huh. Not enough protein.
Just take vitamin B12, doesn't mm-hmm. occur in plant foods. Most vitamins and minerals are not as bioavailable in plant foods,
mm-hmm.
So you just cannot absorb them as well. Heme iron, you can't get that from plant foods. So it's hard without major nutritional supplements to have a nutritionally sufficient diet
mm-hmm.
as a vegan.
Mm-hmm.
Not impossible, but harder.
Mm-hmm.
In animal experiments, they also found that, you can be healthy as a vegetarian, but you have to so carefully combine your nuts, legumes, to get your complete proteins,
mm-hmm.
all of that. It's a much trickier diet mm-hmm. to be healthier on.
And in the same meal? You need
right.
to combine
you have to
them.
Get
you just can't.
Your vegetables and legumes in the same meal in order
mm-hmm.
to make those proteins complete. So
mm-hmm.
you have to. You have to be highly conscientious
motivated.
For that
mm-hmm.
diet to be healthy. Whereas, if you eat a diet that's high in animal foods, those foods all come naturally packaged with complete proteins and the fat that you need, and the fats needed to absorb the fat-soluble vitamins, and
mm-hmm.
and those foods mm-hmm. are packed with the all the basic nutrition that you need,
mm-hmm.
Especially if you include organ meats, as people used to do.
Mm-hmm.
The paleo diet is at the other extreme, and paleo. There's a whole range of what people, what is paleo? A lot
mm-hmm.
of people in paleo don't eat any dairy.
Right.
And that became a movement that became a way to reclaim those foods that had been banned.
Right.
And it's, as in any movement, there's a whole range of different kinds of interpretations of that. But, in general, I think that many people become healthier just eating paleo because it emphasizes real foods.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay. What's next for you?
Well, I'm interested in working on trying to help bring these science-based arguments to nutrition policy. You know, would love to see our nutrition policy based on firmer, better science. It's just so essential for Americans. And, you know, having now had this scientific background, I feel like I have something to offer in that way.
Now, does that mean, is that political? Is that another book? Is that...
I'm going to mainly be doing more writing, you know, more in some investigative pieces and you know, more arguing, writing to just try to present the arguments for, you know, why nutrition policy needs to change.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is an important year because there will be the next set of dietary guidelines are due out in the fall at some point. So you know, I hope that those, they've moved heavily towards a plant-based diet.
I know.
And as you know, only low-fat dairy, which is not good for cheese.
Right. You know, the Fancy Food Show is going on in New York City the past day and today and tomorrow, and I've been talking to a lot of cheese people and telling them what book I was reading and who I was interviewing on the radio, and it's hard even to cheese people who are very pro-fat and pro-dairy. It's hard to explain your book quickly, so I think it would be great if you had articles everywhere explaining your book.
Well, you know, I do have a number of articles on my website. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal that became the most emailed story. It was just a little over a year ago. Most emailed story in recent history, which kind of explains the basic saturated fat argument.
Okay, good. We'll try to put
that.
And
that's on my website.
Okay, great. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. It was very educational reading your book. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Diane, thank you for having me. And next time, I hope I can see you in person and eat some cheese with you.
Yes. That would be great. Okay. Thanks very much. This is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. I'll be back next month. This is heritageradionetwork.org. You can listen by podcast or on Stitcher. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.